Bogdan looks at the board, looks at the pieces. He can't see a way out. Stephen was going to win.
You love Elizabeth, says Bogdan.
Too small a word, that, says Stephen, but yes. Where is she, by the way? She did tell me.
Antwerp, says Bogdan.
Sounds like her, says Stephen. Go on.
When did you know you loved her? Asks Bogdan.
Like ages?
20 seconds, perhaps, says Stephen. I recognized her the moment I met her. I just thought, well, there you are. I've been waiting for you.
Bogdan nods. Do you have a little crush on someone? Asks Stephen.
Is that it?
You can resign the game if you want, by the way. No coming back now, surely.
Bogdan looks at the board. Perhaps there is no way back, but he won't resign just yet.
How do you know if someone likes you? Asks Bogdan.
Well, everyone likes you, Bogdan, says Stephen. But I imagine you mean romantically.
Bogdan nods and looks down at the board again, desperately searching for a way out.
A boy or a girl? Asks Stephen. I've never liked to ask.
A girl, says Bogdan.
Well, then I owe Elizabeth £20, says Stephen.
The best thing to do is just ask. How about a drink? If she says yes, then there's the answer.
But what if she says no?
Then she says no, dust yourself down, plenty more eggs in the omelette, and so on.
Bogdan thinks back to the parapet of the bridge, the rocks and the river below, the yellow jumper his mum had knitted. He looks down at the board and shakes his head. Sometimes the pieces weren't where they were supposed to be. Sometimes you weren't in control. And perhaps that was okay?
He will ask her for a drink. And if she says no, she says no.
Bogdan holds his hand out to Stephen.
I resign.
Good lad, says Stephen. Who is she?
She's called Donna, says Bogdan. Police officer.
Just what you need, says Stephen. Keep you on the straight and narrow. Just ask her for a drink, you ridiculous man.
Bogdan hears the front door open. Elizabeth is back. She walks in with a bag full of files.
Hello, darling, says Stephen. Where have you been?
Antwerp, darling, says Elizabeth and kisses him on the top of the head.
Sounds like you, says Stephen.
You boys having fun?
Bogdan was asking when I knew I was in love with you.
Oh, really? And when was it?
The jury's still out, I told him, giving her the benefit of the doubt for now.
And how did the subject of love come up?
Darling, Bogdan and I must have our secrets, mustn't we?
You must, agrees Elizabeth.
Bogdan looks at the paperwork poking out of Elizabeth's bag. How was Antwerp?
Everything good?
Everything good, yes, says Elizabeth. All taken care of.
Chapter 82. Joyce.
So, Alan will be with me next week. The rescue centre have to come and visit the flat just to check that I'm a fit and proper person. I certainly think I am, but it will be nice to have it confirmed. I am glad they didn't come round last week. Sue had bled all over the kitchen floor. There were millions of pounds worth of diamonds on the kitchen table, and Bogdan was storing 3 guns under the spare room duvet. I don't know what the rules are for fit and proper, but I imagine I would have been breaking one or two of them there. And, by the way, yes, it is Alan, not Rusty. They let us take him for a walk around the grounds, and Ibrahim read the riot act to me. And it does suit him, to be honest. We got on like a house on fire. Ibrahim tried to make him sit, but Alan was having none of it, just happily chasing his tail instead. A dog after my own heart. I took a picture of him while we were there to show Elizabeth and Ron. They both said he looked like trouble, which I know they both meant as a great compliment. Anyway, that photo is at GreatJoy69's Instagram profile picture now, so people can judge Alan for themselves. And, by the by, Joanna solved the mystery of my private messages. She went into my account and searched all of them for me. She told me that if I didn't want to be sent an endless tide of photographs of men's genitals, I should really change my username. Needless to say, I haven't changed it. I know I said I wanted something to happen, do you remember? And it has been fun for the most part, except for Poppy. We met her real mum yesterday. She actually is called Siobhan, which I suppose was all part of the plan. Elizabeth and I sat with her and talked about Poppy, and she and I cried. She had to identify the body which had already been identified. The scars on the back of her leg had actually come from a car accident when she was very young. Siobhan had lots of photographs and we looked through them together. Elizabeth gave Siobhan the poetry book, which had been on Poppy's bedside table in Hove. The bookmark was left where it was on a poem called An Arundel Tomb. Arundel is not too far from Brighton. Jerry and I once went antiquing there. This was before there were Starbucks, but we went to a nice tea room. Poppy's funeral is next week, and we will all be there. Ron is taking flowers for the real Siobhan. Ever the optimist. Ibrahim is driving us. Elizabeth got a bit upset that Douglas had told Sue to stick close to her if she wanted to find the diamonds. Not that it was any sort of big deal, Elizabeth said, but she couldn't help feeling a bit betrayed. I laughed and asked her if she had not worked it out. Douglas told Sue to stick close to her because he knew Elizabeth would eventually catch her out. She took my point and cheered up a little. Maybe a bit of peace and quiet would be nice now, just for a bit. Joanna is popping down at the weekend. She's bringing the football chairman down with her, and I am making lunch. I have invited Ron over too, because he will know what to talk about. I asked Ron what football chairman ate, and he said ham, egg and chips. Luckily, I know Ron's games, so I am doing a roast. I will tell them everything that's been going on except what happened to the diamonds. That's just between Elizabeth, Ibrahim, Ron and me. We decided together and it's our little secret. We all need secrets, don't we? Speaking of which, I have one more secret which you mustn't tell anyone. I haven't even told Elizabeth. I went down to Fairhaven last Wednesday, and there's a little place near the pier. We must have been close to it when everyone was being shot. I'd booked an appointment. I didn't know if you had to, especially on a Wednesday. It only took a few hours, and it still hurts a bit now, but it was worth it. I never wear sleeveless dresses, not with my arms, so no one will ever see it. Unless I get lucky. It's at the top of my left arm, and ever so pretty. Just a small tattoo of a poppy. Chapter 83. Lance James had kept the leaflet that Joyce had sent him. It was too expensive, but a man could dream, couldn't he? He was very glad he kept it, and he had booked the appointment as soon as the money from the diamonds had come through. He looks around the room, bigger than his whole flat. Oak-panelled, carpet, actual carpet. Two huge windows overlooking Dublin Bay. It had been chaos at the end of the pier. The report had taken him a long time to write. Who shot who and why? Leave a few things out, invent a couple of things that perhaps hadn't happened. The footage from the monitors had disappeared. So all that was left was the word of Lance, Bogdan and Connie. Lance and Bogdan had met for a pint, got their stories straight, and that was that. The report was all true enough in the end. He'd written worse. The main thing he had left out, of course, was the two diamonds. They were just sitting there on the desk, for heaven's sake, twinkling like pennies in a fountain. He had slipped them into his pocket, because what was the alternative? Where would they go otherwise? It was the first time Lance had done something illegal, and it would be the last. Well, he had once driven a hire car on holiday with Ruth when, technically, he had been uninsured, but that was about it. If you are going to commit one major crime in your life, Lance reasons, make it stealing diamonds from the mafia. They had given him a few days' leave after the shootout on the pier, told him to take some time to relax. Relax? In the tiny flat he didn't own, with the kitchen wall still half demolished, the builder had, unsurprisingly, not returned to finish the job. So Lance had taken the ferry to Zeebrugge, then the train to Antwerp, then a cab to the jewellery district, and the address he had been given by an arms dealer who owed him a favour. The diamonds as a whole had been worth 20 million, that much he knew. So what were the two he had slipped into his pocket worth? A million? Dare he dream 2 or 3 million? He had been looking through the Rightmove app all the way there. Sue Reardon had told him about Elizabeth Best when this all began. Her reputation, her bravery, her cunning, a legend of the service. He had expected, and in retrospect, Sue must have expected too, that her powers would have deserted her. Sue must have thought Elizabeth Best was an easy touch. But Sue would have a long time to regret her misjudgment of Elizabeth. So Lance should have known, really, when he was on the train, looking at all the expensive houses. The jeweller had examined the stones, nodding and smiling. "These are nice, these are very nice," he'd been saying. "Where had Lance got them?" Lance told him that a relative had died. "You have papers?" "Afraid not." The jeweller had shrugged. No matter. Then he had put down his eyeglass. "Very nice indeed. I can offer you 30,000. Lance must have looked shocked because the jeweller had immediately said, okay, 35. Yes, of course. Lance should have known. He should have known Elizabeth wouldn't have left a million or two or three in the hands of Connie Johnson or whoever else might have ended up with the diamonds in the chaos. She had given Connie the runts of the litter. £30,000 out of 20 million. Lance had started to laugh. He wouldn't have been able to spend a million anyway. The service does yearly audits, unusual spending, extravagances. Checking the Russians or the Saudis weren't paying you. Or that you hadn't just stolen some diamonds from the mafia.
Spending 3 million would have been virtually impossible. But spending 35,000, that had been a breeze. He had bought Ruth out of the flat. Of course, she hadn't asked him where he had got the money because to Ruth, £25,000 was insignificant. And the other 10,000? Well, that's why he was here, in this grand room in Dublin with its oak panels and beautiful windows, with the coffee table stacked with magazines not to read while he waits. He likes to think about what happened to the rest of the 20 million. What has Elizabeth done with it? Maybe she has kept it. Perhaps Sue could have bought her off after all. Lance doubts it very much, though. He wonders if, one day, he might be allowed to ask her. He hopes so. He would certainly like to meet her again. Lance picks up the Sunday Telegraph magazine. The cover image is familiar. Hidden treasure. Is this the most beautiful garden in England? Hidden treasure indeed, he thinks, and wonders what the eventual new owners of Martin Lomax's house might dig up around the place. As he flicks to the article, the nicely groomed man behind the desk in the corner says, "Dr. Morris will see you now." Lance gets to his feet and, for once, runs his fingers through his hair. It'll be good to remember what it feels like before the transplant. "Thank you," says Lance. Chapter 84. Sylvia Finch slips off her suede shoes, still dark from the puddles, and pulls her chair up to the empty desk. She comes in for 2 days a week and has done for around 10 years now, ever since she retired. She has the odd week off, usually when the kids and grandkids come to visit. She doesn't have her own desk. They just put her wherever they have space. Space is tight and money is tight, and Sylvia is glad to just muck in. Glad to help the people who helped her. Wherever they put her, she takes out the picture of Dennis and props it against her computer to remind her why she's there. She logs into the online banking system. Today is just cross-checking the accounts, making sure monies paid in have arrived and making sure nothing unauthorized has gone out. There is usually the odd anomaly, a promised transfer which hasn't gone through, or a staff member buying lunch on the wrong credit card. Never anything really sinister, but always best to check. Today, however, as Sylvia clicks onto the main holding account, she spots an immediate error. The error is amusing, more than anything else, the sort of thing that, in happier days, she would tell Dennis about when she got home. Sylvia rings the bank and gives her details. She runs through the error she has spotted, but is assured that it is not an error, which is impossible. She asks the lady on the other end, Lisa, very friendly, to double-check, which she does. No error. So she asks for a few more details. Sylvia thanks Lisa and puts down the phone. The bigwigs are all in a meeting. 8 of them around a table that is far too small. The bottom half of the glass meeting room wall is frosted, but in the clear pane above she can see the tops of people's heads and, cramped into a corner, the chief executive standing by a flip chart pointing out figures. Sylvia has never interrupted a meeting before, would never dream of it, in fact. She has never liked to draw attention to herself, and she has always been glad accountants very rarely need to interrupt meetings. But in this instance, she probably should. She checks and double-checks the screen, then checks and double-checks the information she has written down. She takes a final look at the photograph of Dennis. her husband, her love. Gone to dementia, then gone forever. The man who died twice.
Courage, Sylvia. Dennis is with you.
As she walks over to the meeting room door, she hears the noise of the discussion and begins to feel awkward. She pauses for a moment outside the door.
What will she look like when she walks in? A silly, thin old woman.
Sylvia, who says good morning, puts the picture of her husband on her desk, then doesn't speak again until she says good evening. Sylvia, who silently holds up his flask every time someone offers her a cup of tea. Sylvia, who doesn't know which jumper goes with which skirt. Well, she supposes she can't change who she is, and this is important. Sylvia knocks. There is a slight pause, then,
yes, come in.
Sylvia pushes open the door, and the faces around the table and the face at the flip chart all turn towards her. She feels giddy. The flip chart is branded with the logo of the charity, Living with Dementia, Living with Love. They had done all they could for her and Dennis, and she gives everything she can to them in return. She has no money to give, and so she gives her time. She sees they are waiting for her to speak, so here goes nothing.
I'm ever so sorry to interrupt, she says. But I don't suppose anyone here knows anything about £20 million from Antwerp.
Hello, everybody. It's Richard Osman here. I'm sorry if my voice is a terrible shock to you after you've had a lovely 11 hours of listening to Leslie Manville's beautiful voice. I'm assuming you've just finished listening to the book anyway. If you've skipped straight to this, that's, listen, you live your life how you wish, but it's an unusual thing to do, and you're going to get spoilers if you have. But hopefully, you've just finished the book. Hopefully, you've enjoyed it ever so much, and hopefully, you've enjoyed the wonderful reading of Leslie Manville. But here's the terrific news. I am actually sitting in a recording studio with Leslie Manville. Hello, Leslie.
Hello, Richard.
And the first time we've ever met, isn't it?
First time we've met, yeah, which seems strange, but that's the times we live in now.
Isn't it just? But your voice is very familiar to me. And listen, not that either of us is a cliche, but the first thing we started talking about was Yorkshire tea. So there's a little bit of Joyce in both of us, I think.
There really is.
Now, we're going to have a little chat about what it is to do audiobooks and all that kind of stuff, just and anything that springs to mind, to be honest. They've asked us to sort of talk about various questions, but I suspect, knowing both of us, we'll go off on a tangent. So
definitely, definitely.
Bear with us, listeners. The first thing, Leslie, let's start with something, which is when they told me with the Thursday Murder Club that you'd agreed to read it, I can't begin to tell you how thrilled I was. I mean, it literally was the best. It was just wonderful.
No, I'm flattered.
Listen, you know, I mean, I'm not going to. Let's not do half an hour on how wonderful I think you are, but I do. Can I ask why you said yes, if you know what I mean?
I do. Well, the truth is, audiobooks are kind of uncharted territory for me. I think I did one many, many, many years ago, maybe even 20 years ago.
Wow.
And it's just not been something that I've done.
Mm.
It's true to say that I'm busy and all of that, but you can always squeeze in an audiobook.
Oh, for goodness sake, yeah.
But
listen, you're not always at the Oscars, are you? You get the odd day off.
No, or at fittings for the Oscars. No, exactly. And actually, when I was asked to do this, it was at the when I was asked to do Thursday Murder Club, it was at the beginning of lockdown in March 2020.
Mm.
And I was doing a play called The Visit at the National Theatre, which was very abruptly taken off.
Mm.
And there I was sitting at home, temporarily twiddling my thumbs, but twiddling them nevertheless. And this offer came through, and we recorded it in a sort of walk-in closet. It's like a tiny little room in my house that's about 9 foot by 4 foot.
Wow.
full of clothes, very beautifully done up, of course,
oh,
Richard.
Sure, I don't want you to think
it was just a mess, this room. It's beautiful. So I recorded Thursday Murder Club. In there, Penguin brought round all the equipment, and I'm not terrible at things like that, so I set it all up and got myself a comfy chair. And that was it. So, yeah, it was a really wonderful thing to do. But I think the part of the thrill of it is that it's not something you can kind of rehearse too much.
Mm.
It requires a kind of on the hoofness about it, if you know what I mean.
And how do you go about it though? Do you read and sort of think about the characters and, you know, think about how you're going to represent each of them, or does a bit of you just dive in?
You dive in, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, my memory was certainly with Thursday Murder Club and The Man Who Died Twice is that I didn't actually have the final versions till quite late in the day.
Oh, apologies. And that would be my fault.
Certainly with Thursday Murder Club, as I say, I was doing this play at the National, so I didn't have time to read. You do write long books, Richard.
Do you think? I mean, listen, if I could get away with writing shorter, I would. I think I'm contractually obliged to write 90,000 words.
Right, OK. Listen, they fly past. But, I read some of it, but certainly not all of it. And I was very reliant on Roy, who directs me and steers me through it. And he knows the book backwards. And
he's here now, isn't he, Roy?
He's here now listening in.
He's keeping quiet, but he's here.
He's a clever boy, our Roy.
Yeah, he seems clever.
So he would guide me and steer me. But, you know, the truth is that they kind of evolved, and they evolve as you read through them. And that I'd really be interested now. The canny audiobook listener will probably listen to the early chapters of Thursday Murder Club juxtaposed with the later chapters of The Man Who Died Twice and think, oh, that Joyce or that Elizabeth has kind of grown into something. And I guess that's inevitable.
Yeah.
But for me, that's the joy of it. I often feel I'm quite good in film and television on a first take because
yes.
There's some kind of instinct that kicks in. And I also love the first stages of rehearsing a play when you are finally kind of off the book and you put the script down and you get on your feet and start doing it. I'm often think that I'm better than maybe on my press night. So I think there's something of the, okay, come on, we've got to do this about doing an audiobook that brings something to the fore.
Yeah, and so you're finding out the plot as the reader is finding out the plot is the truth.
There's been many times when I've got to the end of a chapter and I've just said to Roy, oh my God, I can't believe that's just happened.
They should leave that in, shouldn't they? I'd
they
love that.
Do.
A little audio extra of Jesus going, oh my, I cannot believe Joyce just did that.
Yes. I mean, literally, I've been saying things like that. So it is thrilling for me because I am, finding out as we go along.
And I've got, as I was just telling you, I've got another one on the go as well. So listen,
yes.
you don't have to sign up now, but you could do if you wanted to. You could say, listen, I'm in.
Listen, I'm saying it now. I'm in. I'm in,
go.
Richard.
There we go. I just need that's countersigned by your agent as well. That would be my favourite thing. It's interesting. Lots of people say to me, why do you not do your own audiobook? You know, because plenty of authors do, and I understand it.
Yeah.
But to me, the book is sort of dominated by slightly by female voices, and I'd feel very uncomfortable being Joyce, for example.
Yes, but then I have to do Ron and Ibrahim, don't I?
I know, but I think they act in service of the female characters.
There's no doubt about it. You know, if roles were being divvied out, you'd want to play Joyce or Elizabeth, wouldn't you? They
yes.
are the leading characters of the piece.
And I know sometimes with audiobooks, and we'll talk a little bit about audiobooks, sometimes with them, they do them as plays. They'll have them with like different voices. And I don't
is that right?
Yeah, I don't really like it. If I'm listening to an audiobook, I really get engrossed in it and enthralled in it. And I love the voice that I'm listening to. And if suddenly there's sort of people playing the roles...
It's a different experience, isn't it? I mean, you go to the theatre or films for that experience, but I know what you mean. It's like a personal voice that becomes... it's in your head and you don't want that broken in a way.
Exactly. Now, this is quite often on audiobooks, especially longer ones than this. I sometimes listen on 1.25 speed. I shouldn't tell you that. And so some people will be listening to you like 5/4 quicker than you actually read. So
doesn't that make my voice very high pitched?
Do you know what? It doesn't make a huge amount of difference.
Right.
It only makes a tiny little. I haven't on Thursday Murder Club, by the way, because I wanted to or the Man Who Died Twice, because I wanted to enjoy every moment of it. But I have done that in the past. But are you an audiobook listener or a podcast listener? Do you often go around with people's voices in your head?
No, I don't. I've never listened to an audiobook in my life.
Wow.
But so many of my friends do. Mm. I did actually, when The Man Who Died Twice was sent to me and I wanted to remind myself of what I did with the characters, I did start to listen to the Thursday Murder Club. But I haven't, but that's just clearly a real shortcoming in my life, and I need to address this.
But the big headline is the only audiobook you've ever listened to is the Thursday Murder Club read by Leslie Manville.
Do I sound like an egomaniac?
No, not at all. Well, you know what? Some people don't. I mean, obviously, everyone listening to this is an audiobook listener, and I am as well. I absolutely love an audiobook. I love wandering around and immersing myself in a world. But I absolutely get that some people don't. But the love that you get on Twitter, when I sort of ever say anything about the new book coming out, the amount of people going, oh, please tell us Leslie Manville has signed up again. Please, we have to. I love the way she reads. I can't, you know.
So, oh, that's nice. I don't tweet. I don't do any of that. So
you're not missing anything, Leslie.
No.
I tweet enough for both of us.
Do you? Good. But I'm clearly missing something not listening to audiobooks. Is it nice to do while you're driving?
Yeah, I think driving, I don't know, because I think I would lose focus a tiny bit. I do if ever I've got a long walk or something like that.
And right.
In fact, sometimes I make walks longer than they should be because I'm particularly enjoying a book or I'm particularly enjoying a chapter of a book.
Yes.
And, you know, that just makes a journey go by. Or if I'm sitting on a train or something, yes. I wonder if driving it might be dangerous. Listen, there's plenty of people listening who would have been listening in cars. Tweet us and tell us where and when
and
you
tell
listen.
Us what. But I do, you know, I do train journeys. A train would be a nice thing.
What do you listen? Let's stop talking about publishing for a moment. What do you do on a train, though? How do you kill time on a train?
I'm usually reading a script or something like that.
Oh, there you go. So you're in the business.
Well,
there's always something going on, right? Maybe that's why you don't like audiobooks, Leslie, because you spend your entire life having to listen to actors. And you're thinking, oh, no, I really don't want to hear another actor talking for 8 hours.
Well,
you get enough of that at work.
I don't know. No, listen, I've got the truth is, Richard, I've got nothing against an audiobook. It just hasn't entered my life yet. And I think that it probably is about time it did. Because, yes, there'd be a time and place for it. But I think, you know, a train journey would be quite good, especially the sort of slightly shorter overground train journey I do from my home to central London. That would be, which is about 25, 30 minutes. That would be quite a good time to
dip in. That's kind of perfect. A little 25-minute burst is kind of perfect. But it's interesting, if you look at sales figures, just to talk about that side of things for a moment, it's about 1 in 8 things are audiobooks, which is substantial and is growing and growing and growing as a business, as people get into it. But most people do read the book, but people absolutely. And also, the one thing about audiobooks is you can listen with somebody.
That's true. Yes, that's true.
And it's harder.
Would you have to share? Because I've got those little ones that go, you know, the little AirPods. What are they called?
Yeah, I think they are AirPods. I'm sure they are. Someone will tell us if they're not.
Would you have one in your ear and one in somebody else's?
You could do that, or you could just be at home pottering around the garden.
And have it on the speaker.
Yeah, have it playing out of a speaker, you see.
That's true. So it can be a bonding thing.
Yeah, and have Leslie Manville in quadraphonic sound in your...
Yeah, I really can't. I can't invite people to my home and suggest they listen to my audiobook, though, can I?
Oh, you or I shouldn't do it, Leslie. That's that is definite. That would be absolutely awful. But
now, when you're writing the book, how you map out two books like these, I don't know, because they're so complex and so there's so much going on, and it's very, very complicated stuff. I mean, you're not thinking of the audiobook when you write it, do you? You couldn't possibly be, because you're writing a book.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Of course, after the first one, because I'm aware of your voice, I do occasionally hear it in your voice, which is very different.
Do you?
But I'm not kind of thinking, oh, I'll give Leslie something difficult to say here. I'm not going to put in any tongue twisters or anything like that. No, I'm purely and simply thinking, how do I get the reader onto the next page?
You know,
how do I get them onto the next chapter? You know, what cliffhanger are we going to have here?
Well, I think your end of chapters are sublime.
Oh, thank you.
Every time I get to the end of one of your chapters, it's kind of, oh my God. And you can imagine if you're trying to go to sleep reading book, you'd never manage it, because every chapter you think, well, I've just got to read the next one now.
Well, I do love that. And I think some of that comes from, I think, working in television for so long is I do think you've really got to earn people's attention.
Yes.
You know, because people can switch off or switch over or go and do anything they want, can't they?
Yes.
So at the end of a chapter where I know you could put it down at the end of a chapter. I know that's the moment where if you're ever going to put... None of the chapters are long enough that you're going to put it down in the middle of a chapter. But when you get to the end of one, I know that's the moment. And that's where I want to say to you, yeah, listen, you could put it down.
Yes.
But maybe just one more.
Maybe just one more.
You've only got work in the morning. Maybe just one more.
Just one more.
That's just completely, I never think that consciously, but I'm always, it's a very needy technique.
Just
kind of going, oh, but listen, something interesting is about to happen. Let me tell you, something interesting is about to happen. But no, I don't, I just kind of, the characters entertain me a great deal.
Of course they do. They're wonderful characters. I absolutely love them.
And it's like, I mean, as a writer, you'll tell me as a reader, I tend to write each chapter from a different character's perspective.
Yes.
As I go along, so there'll be like a Ron chapter or an Elizabeth chapter, and it doesn't feel like it's their chapter, but my writing slightly changes. Can you sense that as
definitely,
you're writing?
Definitely. And I always love it when I get to a chapter and it's Joyce. There's something about those, because it's sort of her writing it all down, isn't it, anyway? It's just lovely, really lovely.
If ever I get stuck, which I often do, my agent always says to me, write another Joyce chapter. Because that's the voice where, to me, that just streams out of me. That's not, you know, I'm not having to sort of carefully calibrate anything there, because she thinks in the way I think, which is, I like to think of about 12 things at once and then say the thing I actually mean at the end of a paragraph.
Yes.
And I love that about Joyce, that she can be banging on about a Hoover for 20 minutes and then give you the vital clue to
She really
solve the
goes
murder.
Off at tangents, doesn't she? I love that about her.
It's fun. It's fun to write, because you slightly don't have to follow the rules of normal writing. You can slightly put commas where they shouldn't be and have little kind of extra bits to sentences that shouldn't be there. I don't know how much fun that is to perform.
Oh, it's lovely, because of course, you know, there's no way I could, you know, you couldn't possibly obviously memorize a whole book, and you can't even hope to familiarize yourself with it to the point where you know what's really coming in terms of each sentence, each paragraph.
Yeah.
So it's very in the moment. But given that, I mean, I think there's a beautiful flow to the writing, because I think I would trip up on the reading of it a lot more if it didn't flow, because it would be whatever punctuation you're doing, I think is working really well, because a lot of the time I can read pages and pages and pages without making any mistakes at all.
Oh, I love that. That's quite nice.
And it's because the writing just really, really flows. And
oh, that's kind. I've taken with this. As I say, I'm starting to write the third one. And the Man Who Died Twice. Funnily enough, my partner's reading at the moment, and we're sort of reading out chapters to each other. It's quite a nice way of doing it.
Oh, that's
so
good.
She's here, and so I do get to read my audio, but only to her.
But she gets a private audience.
Yeah, exactly. But me reading it out. Firstly, I didn't do it with the first book. I find it incredibly helpful in terms of working out how I write and think little things that I would change. But secondly, I do stumble quite a lot because every now and again I want to swap two words around. And so I want to read out what's written down, but my brain says, oh, no, just swap those two words around. That's more elegant.
Yes.
And so her reading of it is beautiful and exemplary and, you know, flows. My reading of it is an absolute mess. You know, it's like, what on earth are you doing here? And because I'm constantly thinking, oh, I just tiny little edit there, or just a tiny, you know.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't do it at all. But reading
it
out.
We do it quite quickly as well, I think. I mean, to read a whole book and, you know, as it were, perform it and go back and redo bits and things like that. We do it in, you know, three and a half, four days, which is, I think, pretty good going, really.
I think so. Well, can you take us through the process? Because I don't know the process, I have to say. So the finished book is around about 11 hours edited.
Mm.
And obviously the experience to the listener is they are hearing you read the book from word one to word 90,000 without a pause. But what's the kind of average day when you're recording, say, The Man Who Died Twice?
Yeah, well, The Man Who Died Twice, I actually did the bulk of it in Prague because I was filming there, and I knew it was sort of pressing to get the book done, and our post Prague was going to prove difficult with my schedule. So I knew I had these 3 days off in Prague, so we did it there, which was lovely. I'd have a nice half hour walk to the studio across the Charles Bridge in Prague, which was
beautiful.
So lovely, with not a lot of tourists around for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And it varied. I mean, the first day, I think we did 10 till 6.
Mm.
And then the second day, we ended up starting much earlier because I think we knew that the third day was going to have to be shorter because of my schedule. So, yeah, it's a kind of 10 till 6 day, and you have a lunch break, but you have to have little pit stop breaks in between because you get a bit stir crazy with it, really.
You must do. But so you start on page one, you're a word one of page one. So you presumably do it in order and, you know, read a few chapters.
Yes.
Have a little cup of tea.
Just keep going, really. I mean, just keep going. You know, I might read sort of non-stop, as it were, I mean, stopping if I make a mistake, for a couple of hours, and then we'll stop and have a cup of tea and carry on and then have a, you know, bite to eat. It's that kind of day. And before you know it, the day's ended and, you know, you've done maybe 140 pages or something, 120 pages.
Well, you must. It's very similar to being a writer. A writer is utterly obsessed at all times with word count.
Yeah.
And how many words they've written in a day, and how many words that counts. And you must be. Do you often stop and say, Roy, how many words have we done now?
Not how many, but I've got the manuscript hard copy, and it starts as this enormous.
Wow,
pile
really?
Of A4 pages. And so you kind of look at the end of the day and think, yeah, I've done about a quarter of that.
There's fewer pages. And are there many retakes and things or technical things, or is it fairly plain sailing?
No, well, inevitably, you know, sometimes I will say the wrong word or invert a couple of words, like you said you do sometimes. And either Roy or the sound recordist will spot it, and we just go back and do it. But I think the aim is to try and keep it flowing, because that's when it kind of all happens, really. And I suppose doing The Man Who Died Twice for me from a performance level felt easier because I knew the characters. And you'll be able to answer this because You wrote it. But it seems to me that there's less characters in The Man Who Died Twice to the Thursday Murder Club. I mean, I know all the principal characters are there, but I seem to remember a lot of characters in the Thursday Murder Club and having to
I've got to do another voice out here.
I mean, sometimes you don't have to sweat that too much because there's no point me trying to sound like a man because that would be ridiculous.
Yeah.
But you try and characterise them in a particular way and, have a little... You get very good at thumbnail sketches and Roy gets very good at giving me thumbnail sketches of what the characters are and then
that's good.
You kind of make a quick decision and do it. But as I said earlier, I really enjoy that because it's the reverse of rehearsing a play for 8 weeks.
Well, you know? I'll answer the question about characters and then I will ask you a question that's sort of related to it. So, yeah, the first one, the first draft of the first one, there were so many characters because I'm such a huge fan of crime fiction, always have been, and I love plot. Mm-hmm. And so I had sort of 3 books worth of plot in the first draft of the first one.
Wow.
And we cut it down and cut it down. So, there's a lot of people there. And in the second book, I sort of understood that it doesn't have to be quite so multi-layered is not quite right, but you know, it can be a simpler through line to the story.
Sure.
And you can have fewer, but you don't need to constantly be reintroducing people and reintroducing people.
Yes.
But when a character turns up, does Roy tell you, say a character turns up on page 10,
yeah,
will Roy be able to say, oh, by the way, this character is literally only in this scene. You're never going to hear of this person again.
Yes.
Or this person is in the book all the way through, so be careful with the voice you choose.
No, absolutely, because I've often noticed the chapter ahead and thought, here's this person, and he'll say, don't worry, he's only in this scene and he only says one line and we never see him again. So, you know,
I'll bring you back for the next book, Leslie, and you'll be stuck with the voice. It's interesting because even for me, you know, when I first introduced Bogdan in book one, Thursday Murder Club, he's literally in a cafe. Mm. So he's in a cafe in Waitrose in Tunbridge Wells. And of all the things I thought I'd get in trouble with in the book, the one thing I didn't know was there is no Waitrose in Tunbridge Wells, and the amount
that
of complaints
can't be
I get,
right. There's no Waitrose in Tunbridge Wells.
Do you know what? You
surely
try and do your
not.
Research, but that was one thing I thought. I know it for a fact. There's no way I need to do any research into this. There will be a Waitrose in Tunbridge Wells, and there is not. So the residents
of Tunbridge
Wells.
You're blowing my mind, Richard.
I know, right? So the poor residents of Tunbridge Wells. Firstly, they're absolutely traumatized by the fact there isn't a Waitrose, and secondly, now this book telling them there is. I mean, listen.
It's that cliche, isn't it? That person who writes in outraged of Tunbridge Wells.
Tunbridge Wells, exactly. Well, they are very outraged. So Bogdan was originally only in that scene.
Right.
And he was just there to, if everyone recalls back, Ian Ventham, who's the property developer in that book. I just wanted a scene where we discover how awful Ian Ventham is. And he's trying to get out of paying Bogdan some money.
Yeah.
And just there were a couple of responses of Bogdan's to Ian. And I just thought, you're an interesting character. I like the way you talk.
Right. Okay.
And then I thought, I might get you involved in this book. A little bit more.
Oh, isn't that good? You see, that's great. So he sort of grew organically, really, because you liked him.
Exactly that.
I'm a big fan of Bogdan.
Oh, God, me too.
And I should have married him, I think, in real life.
Don't you think? I mean, listen, again, this is spoilers, but we've all just read the book. I love the fact that he and Donna.
So good.
That's going to work.
So
right?
good. Because they're perfect for each other.
I mean, it'd be fascinating to need to get inside Bogdan's head a little bit more. And I honestly think Donna's the woman to do it. So that's in book three, I'm going to have some fun.
That's great.
With the two of them. I've got some, I can't give away anything about plots. I've got such a lovely plot for Donna in book three.
Oh, have you?
Yeah. Really looking forward to doing. And I suspect Bogdan might have to be by her side.
Yes.
I sort of couldn't bear it if they, I couldn't bear that relationship going badly because
oh,
I
no,
like those
please
two characters
don't.
Too much.
We've got to have some hope.
Yeah, exactly.
Troubled times.
So in the next one, it's interesting. So I gave you like Americans and various things in this book, but the next one, I might have some interesting accents for you. Is there anything you have trouble with, or anything that you love doing?
I'd like to say no, but people I've worked with might disagree. I'm actually I'm actually currently doing a Nottinghamshire accent.
Oh, yeah.
Which is quite complicated.
That's sort of like all the Shane Meadows films, they all have that,
yes,
that sort of...
Yeah, yeah. So, but, yeah, no, I listen. I work with really good dialect coaches, so, you know, they,
right,
they help you. But perhaps what next time, you know, if I'm allowed to do your third book,
oh,
Richard,
I think that's... Yeah,
I think you might need to give me a little bit of a heads up with the accent so I can just get ahead of the game a bit.
Well, listen, you just... all I will say is you might be heading towards Eastern Europe at various points.
Okay.
That's all I
all
can
right.
tell you.
All right. Okay.
There might be there just might be you might have to brush up on your post Putin Russian accent.
Oh, okay. All right.
I think that's doable, isn't it? People, we can
I can definitely do that.
Excellent.
But listen, is it crime novels all the way for you, or do you are you going to be breaking out of that at some point?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, in the same way that I always try and make telly that I would watch, you know, I'm only really interested in writing books that I would read. And I, you know, I love crime fiction and always have done, which is why you never have to second guess if you're writing something that you love. Because, you know, you're not having to think, I wonder what people would like. You just think, well, I know what I like, so I'll write that. But, you know, I've always loved humorous novelists as well, you know, like Michael Frayn and Muriel Spark and Barbara Pym and people like that. So I can sort of see a world in which I would write a novel that maybe wasn't quite so crime-based. But you know what? I love the restraints that crime fiction puts on you. You know, I love that you set up a question at the beginning that you're going to answer at the end.
Right.
You know, my TV format brain enjoys writing in that
genre.
Because...
No, you've definitely got that sort of brain, clearly. And do you map it out? I mean, on page one, do you know what's going to happen 90,000 words later?
No, not really. A little bit.
It's even more impressive then.
Well, I don't know that it is.
Oh. it's worrying, I guess,
at
times.
I talk to lots of other crime writers about it, and some people are, you know, proper planners and you know, have everything worked out. I don't have any post-it notes stuck on the wall with here's where the plot is going. No, not a single thing. I usually have an idea of what the ending is going to be. So with The Man Who Died Twice, the one thing I knew is that where that money was going.
Right.
You know, that's the thing that I knew. And that's the thing I thought, well, that's the heart of the book right there, is that there are ill-gotten gains and there are terrible people, all of whom want those ill-gotten gains, but they're going to be used for good.
Right.
And, you know, so I knew that I sort of knew. And I knew that I knew from the previous book that the person who put the letter under her door was this guy. I didn't know it was her ex-husband at that point.
Right.
That again came to me where I thought, oh, listen, I know that Elizabeth's been married before. Well, listen, how much more fun is this? Douglas is her ex-husband, because you learn more about him, you learn more about her. But so lots of the time the story sort of writes itself, so I know where I'm headed. But the lovely thing about crime fiction is you can sort of reverse engineer it sometimes, in that towards the end you can think, oh, this would be a lovely thing. And then you think, oh, if I write this in chapter four, then it would look like I planned this all along.
Yes.
And no one ever knows the order you wrote things in.
No.
So it's I don't.
Surely, hang on a minute. Surely you've got to write it chronologically, a crime fiction story, surely.
Yes, a bit. Sort of like the one I'm doing at the moment, I know what the first 20,000 words is. So that's 20,000 out of 90,000. I know that's about the first 20 chapters. I know where they're headed.
Mm-hmm.
I also know the end. So I know the climactic scene. I know where it takes place.
Right.
And I know who I want to be involved in that climactic scene.
Right.
So I have those two tent poles.
Okay.
And then everything else in between is, well, look, how do I get from this lovely...
Oh, I see. Yeah, no, I can see the logic of that now you're explaining it. Yeah.
I mean, you know, from any good film script or any play, you know, if you've got the three-act structure. So I've got my first act and I've got my finale.
Mm.
And then when writing the second act, so many unusual things can happen that actually sort of start changing your first act and changing your finale. Mm. So that's sort of where I am. I know where it's going to finish.
Right.
But I don't know which route we're going to take.
Okay.
To get there, essentially.
Yeah.
It seems to be working so far.
Yes.
You know?
It I think you're doing all right.
So your audiobook, presumably, because obviously, presumably that's in America. I mean, all the kind of English-speaking countries are all listening to you doing the Thursday Murder Club and The Man Who Died Twice.
Wow.
That's quite fun, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Am I big in America?
Well, I mean, you must be, right? Is there any way we can get you in the film?
Yes.
Don't you think?
I'm a bit too young for Joyce or Elizabeth, though, happy to say.
That's the issue. But you'd be a very good Sue Reardon, maybe.
Yes, that's true.
In this, but you could play
her. Do I need to get my people to speak to your people?
Well, don't you think? I mean, listen, I mean, you know Spielberg, don't you, for goodness
actually,
sake?
Actually, now you see, here you go. Yeah. This is I've got a Spielberg story.
Oh, yes.
So I'm at the Oscars with Phantom Thread, which was a film I did with Daniel Day-Lewis. And I'm sitting next to Daniel because we're both nominated. Mm. And Stephen comes up and says, obviously he knows Daniel very well. And I thought, it's Steven Spielberg. Is he just going to think, he's not going to know who I am? He turns to me and he goes, hello, Leslie. I thought, that's it. My life is made.
No way.
Yes.
Seriously.
Well, he'd watched the film, obviously.
I know, but...
As he would, as you'd expect he would. But, you know, I thought it's going to take Daniel to say, Stephen, this is Leslie.
Yeah.
But it didn't.
It didn't. I mean,
said,
that's really,
hello,
really
Leslie.
Cool. Well, listen, we must be able to make this happen.
Yes.
Mustn't we? And also, we can age you up, can't we?
Anything's doable, yes.
For goodness sake, if we're going to do, you know, five movies, you know, we need someone who's going to...
It's a five-movie deal. I'm in.
Yeah, you're in? Excellent, that's very good. We must. So the two things, I need to get you in the film, I need to get my mum a cameo in the film as well. That's the other
thing
that she
wants.
Can she act? Well, I think we'll just have her in the background.
Okay, fine.
I think to my mum, just sitting in a restaurant while someone else is acting would
count as... I like that.
Would count as that.
And listen, you've got to be in it too, because in the Hitchcockian mode of things, I mean, come on.
I don't know. It's unusual. The rest of the world, it would be fine. I think in England, it would be peculiar because everyone would be, why is the guy from Pointless in this Hollywood movie? This seems...
There's going to be no problem hiding you. It really is.
Well, then that's the other thing. I can't really disguise myself. You go, who's the enormously tall cop they've just got working on this murder squad? But also, I don't think, genuinely, I've been around film sets very rarely, but enough to know that if you've got a cameo in a film, literally that's all day in a tiny trailer. And 15 takes of something that someone messes up while you're having to pretend to drink coffee.
Yeah. Yes.
I just don't know. I don't know if I've got it in me.
No, it's a particular skill, being what used to be called an extra and is now called an SA.
Oh, supporting artist. Is
yeah,
that right?
It's a skill.
So you were doing a lot of this in Prague, which I think Elizabeth particularly would approve of.
Yeah.
But that is and so you did some in Prague and you did some back here, and is there any? I mean, how's your mood? Does it change the way you read? Will people be able to work out which bits you did in Prague?
No.
No, of
course
not. It will
be seamless.
Wow.
Seamless.
That's
you won't go, she's suddenly in a London studio and she was in Prague. No, you won't be able to tell the difference.
Okay, I trust you absolutely. and as we meet today, I mean, listen, this will go out quite soon, won't it? Because September, this is going out. It is middle of, so towards the end of July, isn't it, when we're talking now? So actually not that far away from it going out. But you've just come back from The Crown.
I haven't actually started shooting. The Crown, I start shooting in a few weeks. But I'm in, prep for it, you know, the fittings and wig fittings and rehearsals and dance rehearsals and all the myriad things you have to learn how to do, not least of all, Richard, put on a tiara, which I can tell you is no mean feat.
Is there a technique to it that we were unaware of?
So I start filming that quite soon.
Oh my goodness, my mum will be so excited because she loves your reading of the book and she loves The Crown. I mean, that's like her two favourite things put together.
What's not to like?
And has this whetted your appetite, Leslie, to do any more audiobooks, or are you going to stay exclusive to Joyce, Elizabeth, Ron and Abraham?
Well, I think I should stay exclusive to you for the time being. Yeah, I mean, it seems only proper, especially if you've got a third book that you're writing.
And a fourth.
I don't want to spread myself too thinly in the audiobook world.
I think so. Listen, have a hit and stick with it.
I've got it. Listen, we've won a prize, haven't we?
Yeah, we have indeed. Yeah, we won Audio Book of the Year.
Audio crime, audio fiction book of the year. I mean,
I love the way I say we.
You got it and I got it. We both got the lovely Bristol blue glass.
That's rather nice, isn't it?
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
So, no, I think that I'm happy to I'm happy to stick with the trilogy of Joyce and Elizabeth, Ibrahim and Ron for the time being.
Well, I'm absolutely thrilled to have you on board as well, I have to say. It's honestly, Lizzie, it's fascinating with audiobooks. And obviously, you know, the book is very dear to me and very personal to me and all of those things. And the reaction to it has been absolutely lovely and people are lovely about it. But to have you giving voice to that is such a privilege for me and such an honour for me. To have something that gets across what I wanted to get across in such a beautiful way that really connects with people is a huge gift. So from me to you, I'd like to say a very, very hearty thank you.
Well, thank you. I mean, it really has been a gift to do. And as you know, as I said earlier, as being a bit of an audiobook virgin, as it were, it's just been very nice to do it and to get the feedback from you that I've done it okay, which is fantastic.
And you'll get that feedback from the listeners as well. Until the next time when I throw a load of Russians at you, and then it's all back up in the air again. Lizzie, shall we say goodbye to the listeners?
Shall we make ourselves a pot of Yorkshire tea?
What a lovely thing to do! And let's do this again for the third book, shall we?
Definitely, excellent. definitely.
Leslie, thank you so much. And everybody listening, again, thank you. I'm a huge audiobook fan and I know how much you love Leslie's reading. And I really hope it's given you an enormous amount of pleasure. And stick around for the next one as well, because I think you're going to enjoy that. And you've heard Leslie admit that she is absolutely committed to doing it again, which I know you'll be delighted about. But enjoy the rest of your day. And thank you so much for listening to the book. It means a great deal.
Thank you, Richard, too.
We hope you've enjoyed this Penguin audio production of The Man Who Died Twice by Richard Osman, read by Leslie Manville. It was produced by Roy McMillan. The post-production was by Jack Beattie, and the audio proofing was by Holly Owen. Recording copyright, Penguin Audio, 2021. Text copyright, Richard Osman, 2021. All rights reserved. The moral rights of the author have been asserted. For more Penguin Audio productions, visit us at penguin.co.uk/audio. Thanks for listening.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.